This is The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. What if the way you say butter says more about you than you think? We all have an accent. Yes, even you. And every dropped R or stretched vowel carries clues about where we're from, who we identify with, and even who we aspire to be.
Today, we're joined by sociolinguist Valerie Fridland. She's the author of the new book, Why We Talk Funny, The Real Story Behind Our Accents. She'll explore the surprising science and social forces behind how we speak, from why some accents are judged as prestigious to how language shapes belonging. This conversation might just change the way you hear every voice, including your own. Valerie, welcome back to The Mountain Life. It's great to have you back.
Well, I love a repeat. So thank you for having me. It's great to be here today.
Even as I pronounce the word prestigious, where I grew up, we said prestigious. I mean, that's more about pronunciation, but maybe that's a good place to start. I think we lump all lexicon and dialect and accent all into one big heap about language. And all of it really reflects who we are and where we are from. But you're talking in this book mostly about our accents. So can you distinguish for us?
Sure. And I mean, that's a really good question because I think a lot of people kind of conflate the different levels of language. And in linguistics, we typically study one level of linguistics at a time. So whether we're interested in vocabulary or the sound system or, you know, the way that people construct sentences, those would be different areas of linguistics. So in looking at a dialect, you'd look at all of those things. So how do different varieties of a language pronounce a particular word? Also, how do they say a particular thing? So, you know, the soda pop Coke divide, for example. And maybe how do they structure sentences? So I'm, you know, from the South. So for me, I could say might could do that. But if you're living somewhere else, you probably can't say that. So that would be the level of dialect. That's everything you're looking at that sort of describes how different varieties vary. But for me, I'm particularly interested in the pronunciation patterns that we have based on who we are, where we grow up, and sort of even things like our ethnicity, our politics, our social class. All of those things actually affect the way you pronounce things. And so for me, that's a really particularly unique and fascinating side of dialect that we often don't think about. And that's why, you know, I studied it for a living and wrote about it in this book.
Yes. Well, it's the way you set the stage about the socio-political aspects, and it's a history. It's about how our accents even evolved, depending upon sort of where we came from in England and maybe even why we were coming to the new land. Can you just give us an overview of that?
Absolutely. I think it's funny how we kind of think about accents as just this thing that exists, and we don't actually ever learn about their history of how did they come to be this way. And I think a lot of that is because we sort of have this belief in a pure system, that there exists somewhere out there, this accentless, you know, perfect original from which all other things deviate, and usually not in a good way. So I think it's partially just our belief system about what accents are that makes us never really delve into how they got to be the way they are. And there's actually a fascinating history behind pretty much every accent you can come up with, and how certain social facts about us, like our social class, for example, that really we can read off of people's speech pretty easily. A lot of times we make judgments about what class someone belongs to or the type of job they'd be appropriate at by hearing them talk. And that's often something that we just don't think about in terms of the history of how that developed. So part of what I do is start at the very beginning because, you know, accents had to come from somewhere. Just like my daughter used to ask me when she was little, where do babies come from? And I'd say, well, their mother. And she's like, yeah, but where did the mother come from? So there's so much more depth to the history of accents than just, you know, I sound like my parents or where I'm from. How did we ever even start to have accents in the first place? So that's really where I start, is accents in our ancient ancestors' mouths. And then once we figure out, okay, well, you know, when you were originally speaking the same language and you separated, you had, you know, much smaller groups of people at that time. And these groups of people would set out and develop sort of societies or cultures in different areas, they would be separate from each other. And their little tendencies of mouth and mind that we have at work all the time in the way that we talk, and it leads us towards certain types of changes. How those changes are realized in different groups when they're separated will vary slightly. And so over time, these differences accumulate, and they're all born of the exact same pressures, but they just are realized with different outcomes. But after you get 20, 30 of them happening over a generation or two or three, you're going to sound pretty different. And because you're not talking to each other, it's going to identify you in terms of the groups you belong to and the groups that you don't. And so this happened over and over and over through history. And that's what gave us sort of the original accents. And then the more people don't talk, the more those accents can turn into completely separate languages. But a lot of times we maintain some contact with, you know, the people that spawned our accents. And that's why, for example, we still speak English in America, even though we've been separated from the British for a while. But there was a lot of contact that kind of reinforced the fact that it's the same language. So you usually don't develop completely new languages. You end up developing versions of the same one. And then you're born as a child with that as your input. And so that's how accents continue on across the generation. So that's something else I talk about in the book. There's a historicity to accent that we sort of ignore. It goes back generations. But also there's a rebirth of accent in every generation. And so accents are about our ancient ancestors, but they're also about the process of acquiring a language and relationships as a child. And it's those relationships that really enforce the types of speech we're going to have as adults. And what we don't realize when we're talking about accents being good or bad, or, you know, why don't you all sound this way because that's how you'll get professional success. The reality is we don't learn our accents at 25. We learn them at 5. And they're about the people we love and the people we spend time with and the people that matter to us. And that's really the bread and butter of our accent. So, you know, there's a lot that goes into it from just sort of the way that accents tend to pattern from a universal linguistic standpoint, but also the way that accents serve a social function for us as people that have strong relationships in our communities. And that's really the start of accents. And then, right. Of course, there's specific accents that I also talk about in the book in terms of their specific histories. And that's like, how do class accents get born in English? And how do African-American accents get born? And things like that. So there's also developmental origin stories for those as well. But the basic fact is, whenever we put groups of people together and they have some commonality that binds them in terms of social experience, of struggle, of love, of affection, they are going to start sounding more alike because of a natural tendency we have towards something called speech accommodation. And over time, their speech will continue to evolve in new directions, but the same way because they're important to that group. And that's what accents mean to people. They mean identity. And really, that's why they're so incredibly beautiful and wonderful examples of sort of the long story of humanity.
Yeah. Well, you work on sociolinguistics, which means you spend a lot of time thinking about how accent and dialect signal identity, class, race, region, generation. In some countries, like England, for instance, there's a huge awareness of class as demonstrated by accent. There's the posh accent and very many other ones. The U.S. was founded in the spirit of pushback to those classist systems. But a couple hundred years in, how much of talking funny is just as enmeshed with those systems of power and status?
Well, speech has always been tied up with power and status. That's always been the time that we have, sorry, let me start that over. Speech has always been tied up with power and status. And even if we look back to Greek antiquity, we see that there are comments about the right kind of speech. So this is something that's always been around. But I think what is different in the United States is it was really founded by not only this ideal of having a less classist society, but also with the backbreaking labor of people across all classes in its early conception. So when we had early settlers here, there were people of aristocratic background. There were people that were indentured servants. There were enslaved people. There was this incredible melting pot of people from all different ranks and stations. And what we find in the first 100 years of the New World's founding by British colonists, are of the New World settlement by British colonists, is that what we find most commented on by British observers is the fact that the American language is uniform. So the accent that they noticed was more that there was a lack of class distinctions or a lack of regional distinctions, which were incredibly prevalent in Britain. So in Britain, you couldn't, you know, walk down the street or to a neighboring village without having someone sound completely different. And you'd be able to tag someone, you know, in terms of class and where they were from that accent. And so what we see most often referred to in these early documents in, you know, 1700, 1720 is how incredibly uniform the American accent was and how it really didn't bear much ancestry to its British roots. I don't think there's ever been a time, though, when status didn't matter. So different forms of status became important. And certainly today there's less classist dialect differences in America than back in Britain, where there's still very significant class distinctions in the way that people talk. But it's absolutely the case that local accents get heard in America as working class much more often than they get heard as upper class, with the possible exception of, you know, early 1900s New England accents, the sort of Kennedy-esque aspect of it, or the East Coast boarding school aspect of it.
Right.
But beyond that, typically any recognizable accent gets heard as a lower class accent. So it's not that we've avoided it. It's that how we defined it is a little different. And there's still more mobility with those accents in America than you tend to find back in Britain.
Well, the American accent, the way it's portrayed in historical media always cracks me up. Like you see a movie from the 1600s, early 1700s, and the moment these pilgrims arrived, they started speaking the way we do now. When do you feel that the American accent, as we are accustomed to hearing it, would be recognizable to us?
It was actually pretty recently that the voices that we think of as American would have sounded American. It's true that an American sound developed early on. So within a few generations of the settlers, the original settlers from Jamestown and the Plymouth Colony getting here, the babies hear all this diverse input and they level out or sort of smooth out really significant differences that are outliers, and they sort of go towards an average tendency. So if more of the accents had a certain feature, it would be more likely to stay. And if it was sort of a more rare feature, only a couple accents had it, it would die out. And so they converge pretty quickly. So we have to assume within one or two new generations of children, there was no longer a British sounding accent, but more of an American sound. So in that sense, an American accent was born early, but it would have sounded absolutely nothing like any of the accents we have today, which really came about in the 1800s. So we don't see a lot of mention about regional accents until the 1800s. And part of that, of course, is because of the Revolutionary War. It became more and more important to sound American. And so we see more commentary about these regional differences fracturing this really fragile union of states that had bonded together for the revolution but were fraying because they had individual desires and identities and communities.
Well, fast forwarding to modern day, Valerie, is that this notion that there is a standard American accent, and I think if we really generalize, we can say, oh, in the South, they sound this way. In the East, they sound this way. In the Midwest, they sound this way. And then there's the whole West. And I have heard people picked out as, oh, that's a California accent. But I think in the West, we think of ourselves more as having that standard American accent. Now, that said, I'm going to tell you, I'm not from Utah, but I've lived here for quite a long time. I was in the middle of my Italian lesson, to which I am quite devoted. And my Italian teacher from Napoli told me I sound like a Utahn when I speak Italian.
My gosh, that is really hysterical. I wonder what, did she tell you what it was she noticed?
Well, actually, she distinguished someone from Utah from someone from New York, how they speak Italian. And I have heard that sort of difference when I hear people from different countries with different accents speaking English. But that brings me to this notion of, like, you know, we think we have this neutral accent or the standard American accent. But what would you say about that? Because you live in the West, you live in Reno.
I do. Although I didn't grow up here, I have lived here for a long time. So many things of what you just said are fascinating and have some really interesting linguistic research behind them. One thing is just talking about the Western accent, one thing that's really fascinating, if you look at the developmental history of American accents, because, you know, they started in the 1800s in terms of getting commented on, but that was really the northern-southern distinction and maybe the mid-Atlantic colonies, so that sort of corridor in the Midwest that had been settled. But the West was settled quite a bit later, and it was settled from fundamentally different inputs than the East Coast. So one of the reasons we believe in this sort of uniform Western fantasy, because I think anybody that lives in the West has heard people from different areas say things differently, so that you can kind of tell sometimes, but we definitely do think of the West as being more homogenous. A lot of that has to do with the fact that the accents that formed the Western dialect region were already American. So they were already American English sounding, mm-hmm. and the differences that leveled out were differences among American regional dialects rather than differences among, say, British dialects, Scots-Irish, and German and Scandinavian languages that were sort of the inputs to the dialect areas that formed the East. And so that's a fundamentally sort of different process mm-hmm. that's already taking a more uniform input and making it even more uniform. So can you see how that would lead to this homogeny that people talk about? And yes, yeah, it probably absolutely. Was maybe more homogenous at that time, although I still think anytime you have separate speakers, they probably could tell the difference. But what happens over time, then you form subcommunities, and those subcommunities have more in common. And whenever you get commonalities and shared interactions and histories and experiences that are shared, language develops along the same corridors in those areas and gets less in common with the other places it doesn't talk too much. So I think, you know, when you talk about Utah accent, there are absolutely things that people call out as being particularly Utahing. Utahan? Mm-hmm. Utahan? How do you call yourself?
Utahan. I will pick out one of them that always gets me. In Utah, you'll hear someone say this: I've decided to sell my car. I'm going to list it for sell.
For sell.
And I've even seen it in a text message. Instead of S-A-L-E, they write, I'm going to put it up for S-E-L-L, for sell.
Oh, or I also love insurance. Like, it can even be like the
stress pattern.
The stress pattern, or permit. I've never heard, not permit the verb. We're talking about, I'm going to go get a hunting permit. You're like,
oh, that's interesting, the stress pattern. So, right, that's actually something people often refer to in the Southern accent, that there's a difference in stress pattern with more first syllable stress in Southern English. So that would be interesting if maybe that had some Southern English origin of an earlier settler stream that might have settled some area of Utah. But what you're talking about with the sill for sell, that is actually referred to as the feel-fill merger, which is actually hard to say together. And it's that L, it's called neutralization before L, which causes vowels to kind of fall in together. What's really fascinating is that most Americans do this in other cases with another sound that's actually very similar from a phonetic standpoint to L, which is R. So the word M-E-R-R-Y, M-A-R-R-Y, and M-A-R-Y, those actually historically are three different vowels. Yes. It's exactly that same pressure that L's and R's put on the vowels that occur before them that leads them to merger. And that's a sort of iconic classic Utah feature. Although the truth is we find it elsewhere, it's just not as stereotyped a marker in other places. But in Utah, the other thing that's often remarked on is the glottalization of T. Mountain, kitten,
button,
right? Button. Although that actually is also a more widespread feature, and I've even seen studies on it occurring in New York. So it hasn't gotten this sort of iconic classification elsewhere as it has in Utah, but it's certainly not an only Utah feature. What it has inspired in Utah, though, is sort of a hyper-correct version of this. That's mountain, kitten. That's the other way. That goes too far the other way. So it's kind of interesting how one feature of the accent inspired another new feature of that accent.
That's so funny. It's very difficult with that that wonderful ski resort we have just over the hill called Brighton. It's either Brighton.
Yes. And if you're under 30, it's probably Brighton. If you're over, it's a little different. Yes. Great. Right. Age is pivotal because when we're young, that's when we are most likely to have innovations in our speech and most likely to pick up innovations from others because we have, you know, social identity is so important and so intense in high school. And that's really the formative years of our accents. And so it's young people that kind of push things forward in speech and adult and older adults that push back.
Yeah. I always wonder when it seems like there are some times where people try to tamp down their accent because they feel it'll be advantageous for them to maybe sound more professional or sound more posh or whatever it is, or even the opposite, where they might play it up a little bit to sound a little more folksy or a little more relatable. Does it work? Can people always kind of tell, or do you think that you can effectively do those things?
I think it really depends on the context and the speaker. So, you know, when politicians do that, I think it lacks an authenticity because you kind of know that they're trying to get on your good side for a very specific reason. So, you know, I think in that sense, we hear it a little more cynically. But when everyday people do it, we often do it in a more subtle level where we all naturally shift along what we call a linguistic repertoire, which is just a fancy way of saying that, you know, we have different elements of our personalities and we sometimes need language to express those different elements and our accents are part of that. So we can have complex social identities that have different aspects of accent go with them. I think it's a fallacy that we just have one version of ourselves in speech, just like we don't have one version of ourselves in our personality. And so, you know, we do pick up little features that help us say that. And that's like when non-Southerners say y'all, you know, is it inauthentic in the sense they're not from a place where that's the regional classic way to say it? Yes. But is it authentic in the sense that they're trying to go for this more folksy communal feel with saying it than, you know, you guys? Or something, I think then you could say yes. So it depends on the context very much, but I will say that sometimes it does feel like it's an exploitative mode if someone's trying to sell you something or get your vote.
Or how many drinks they may have had, because I've noticed that when I'm a little tipsy, my Midwestern flat A's come right out to.
I think it's just the less monitored speech. So, you know, as you mentioned, we all have a more casual and more formal style. And that's sort of the most typical variation that we do. So everybody, no matter what their accent is, will talk differently to their friends at a bar than your boss seeking a promotion. You're just not going to use the same, not just accent, but words, you know, sentence structure, everything. So when we are more relaxed, and drinking, of course, will do that to you, then our less inhibited, less monitored speech comes out. And for a lot of us, the speech we use at work is probably more monitored and less authentic, I will say, than the one that we use with our friends at home when we're not working to put on any kind of facade or air. And so I would argue that maybe that's your true self linguistically, if there is such a thing, and that what you have learned is a sort of style that you put on elsewhere. And it doesn't make that inauthentic as much as just maybe not your home accent.
Instead of having to say y'all or you guys, I start to say y'all when I'm in the South because it sounds really strange to say you guys. I just wish that we had a plural.
It, you know, every version of that, every you guys, y'all, yins, yous, is an attempt by English speakers to solve a long-term problem of our language that we don't have a good plural second person. I mean, we did, but we got rid of it. And right, because you, thou was singular and you is actually plural. So you alone historically was the plural form and we got rid of the distinction. So now you stands in for both singular and plural. And speakers have been trying to make up for that lack for years. And in fact, y'all is a really fascinating etymological history because it seems to have stemmed from the Scots-Irish ye all, which meant you all. And that got kind of in fast speech merged together to y'all. But it was also helped along by enslaved African Americans that had a that spoke Igbo, that had a word in Igbo that specifically said "you all." And since there were a lot of Igbo speakers where "y'all" was probably developing, that helped push it, you know, to the forefront of language use there. So I think "y'all" is a great solution, both from a historical perspective and the fact that we just need a stinking pronoun.
We really do. Well, Valerie Fridlin, it is such a pleasure to talk to you. I feel like I could talk more about this for hours. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Valerie Fridlin is a linguist and the author of a new book, Why We Talk Funny. Valerie, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Boy, okay. Chatting with you all.
You too. Yeah, thanks great. A lot for being with us.
With y'all.
Yeah.
With all y'all.
I'll use yuns.
See you later. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you so much.
You too.